I do have more than six, coincidentally.
All right, sorry.
No, it's all right. I make good doorstops and bought in bulk. The wolf. She wants you to lie down with the wolf, the one who eats chalk to make his words as white as snow, so each letter lands in a puff of smoke. The one who likes red, who stays in bed so long he could become just another pattern in the wallpaper. She wants you to lie down with the wolf, the one she has clothed in wool from the mountain sheep, the one who is not as he appears, the one who treads time beneath his paws, which are always caked in flour, the one the children sing of. If you lie down with the wolf, the one who carries the wind in his belly, the one who can take a house from you, the one who hides in shadow, so the boy who cries wolf is a liar, she'll stroke your hair and smile secrets at you, slit him open and fill him with stones, and watch you both sink. So I always start off with that poem because I haven't got an introduction for it. I don't know what it's about.
Very strange.
I am very strange. So this next one, in between teaching trumpet in different schools, I used to go to the local Wetherspoons for my lunch. So this is Tuesday at Wetherspoons. All the men have comb-overs, bellies like cakes just baked, risen to roundness. The women tilt on their chairs, laughter faked, like mugs about to fall, cheekbones sharp as sadness. When the men stand together, head for the bar like cattle, I don't understand why a woman reaches across, unfolds his napkin, arranges his knife and fork to either side of his plate. They're all doing it, arranging, organising, all talk stopped until the men, oblivious, return. My feet slide towards a man with one hand between his thighs, patience in his eyes who says, you can learn to love me. Ketchup on the hand that cups my chin, ketchup around his mouth, now hardening on my skin. So that one, I wouldn't normally say this because I think it's a bit crass, but it won a prize, and the judge said it was a convincing version of Dante's Lower Rings of Hell. And actually, it's just the Wetherspoons in Barrow. So this next one, I had a friend come to stay from Canada, and she's into going to spiritualist churches. And asked me if I would go with her, and I cynically thought at least I'll get a poem out of it. So this is Hartley Street Spiritualist Church. Sorry, I forgot, can you hear me at the back? Okay.
Yeah.
Hartley Street Spiritualist Church. The first hymn is I Believe in Angels by ABBA. No music because Gene has forgotten the tape. We sing without, led from the front by a medium with long red hair, who announces that a dog is in the room and is at this very moment sitting next to the tea urn. This means someone is ready to be healed. Another medium stands, running coloured ribbons through her hands, points behind her and says a woman is pacing up and down, flicking her hair and pouting, and will anyone claim her? Does anyone have a relative who would do such a thing? And then the psychic artist stands up, unrolls a scroll, a picture that he drew many years ago in anticipation of this day, a man in a flat cap with a cigarette, a man who used to get back from work and watch the sun go down from his back porch and smoke, and he says, this is your granddad, isn't it? To a woman who nods vigorously. And then he starts to draw an old lady with short hair, who he says is standing next to me. And am I feeling warm? because this is the energy of spirit. And do I ever feel I'm being followed, even though there's no one there? Because this is the energy of spirit. And come to think of it, I think I am warm, but that might be because everybody is staring, and he's whispering over and over, "It's your grandma, isn't it?" And I believe him. I want to think she's there, even though in his drawing she has permed hair and glasses. He gives me the image of this woman. Later on, I bin it. But before we go, we sing "I Believe in Angels" again. And of course, not everything in a poem has to be true, but that is all true, except I'm being slightly unfair because the mediums were only in training, they weren't fully qualified. I think Barrow, in fairness, tourist board should employ me to bring people to their town, because you can go to Hartley Street Spiritualist Church if you ever found yourself in Barrow, which is probably unlikely.
Whereabouts is Barrow?
In Cumbria, in the Lake District.
Alright, that's where the nuclear power station was.
Yes, it was. I thought you were going to say that's where William Wordsworth was.
I saw horses pulling that.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Right. So this next one, I go and do poetry workshops in Sheffield, and I have to get the 6 o'clock train from Barrow, because Barrow's in the middle of nowhere, probably because it's got a nuclear. So I get the 6 o'clock train, which is full of strange people, and then on the way back I get the last train, and I try and spot who's going back to Barrow, because it's the last stop on the line, and you can always tell them. Except I am as well, so what does that say about me? But anyway, so this is train journey, Barrow to Sheffield. Even though the train is usually full of people I don't like, who play music obnoxiously loud, or talk into their phones and tell the whole carriage and their mother how they're afraid of dying even though they're only 25. Even though the fluorescent lights and the dark outside make my face look like a dinner plate, even though it's always cold around my ankles and the guard is rude and bashes me with his ticket box, even though the toilet smells like nothing will ever be clean again, even though the voice that announces the station says Bancaster instead of Lancaster, still I love the train, its sheer unstoppability, its relentless pressing on, the way the track stretches its limb across the estuary as the sheep eat greedily at the salty grass, and thinking that if the sheep aren't rounded up, will they stand and let the tide come in, because that's what sheep do, they don't save themselves, and knowing people have drowned out there, like the father who put his son on his shoulders as the water rose past his knees and waist and chest and rang the coast guard, who talked to him and tried to find him, but the fog came down, and though he could hear the road, he didn't know which way to turn. But in a train there are no choices, just one direction, one decision you must stick to. This morning the sun came up in Bolton, and oh, the sky was red, and a man in a suit fell asleep and dribbled on my shoulder, till the trolley came round and rattled in my ear, and he woke up with a start and shouted, "I've got to find the sword." I'm just going to read two more from the pamphlet, and then I'm going to try a couple of newer ones. So I'm going to read the title poem, which I wrote after reading a book by Sean Ellis, who went to live with wolves in Canada, and then he took his girlfriend with him and then got dumped, and then he had another girlfriend and got dumped, and this theme runs throughout his autobiography that he wrote. And his excuse for this is that if we behaved more like wolves, then he wouldn't have got dumped by these women, and it was nothing to do with the fact that he smelled like a dog and was probably a complete pain in the backside to live with. So this is "If We Could Speak Like Wolves." If I could wait for weeks for the slightest change in you, then each day hurt you in a dozen different ways, bite heart-shaped chunks of flesh from your thighs to test if you flinch, or if you could be trusted to endure. If I could rub my scent along your shins to make you mine. If a mistake could be followed by instant retribution and end with you rolling over to expose the stubble and grace of your throat. If it could be forgotten the moment the wind changed. If my eyes could sharpen to yellow. If we journeyed each night for miles, taking it in turns to lead. If we could know by smell what we are born to. If before we met, we sent our lonely howls across the estuary, where in the fading light, wader birds stiffen and take to the air, then we could agree a role for each of us, more complicated than alpha, more simple than marriage. So I was getting married at that point, so I was probably having a few commitment phobic issues of my own.
You haven't had a clap.
So I got married, and then I wrote this one, which is In Praise of Arguing. In Praise of Arguing. And the vacuum cleaner flew down the stairs like a song, and the hiking boots launched themselves along the landing. And one half of the house hated the other half, and the blinds wound themselves around each other. And the doors flung themselves into the street and flounced away, and the washing gathered in corners and sulked. And the bed collapsed and was held up by books, and the walls developed scars, and it was a glorious, glorious year. I'm not going to read all of these. I haven't put them in order because I was too busy talking. I got them out and then I forgot to put them in order. It's John's fault for calling me Baldy. Baldy Kim. It's flustered me. So normally I don't tell people that I'm a peripatetic brass teacher because they always mishear and I just say, oh, I teach the trumpet. So I do about 16 schools a week at the minute, because I'm just working part time as a trumpet teacher or brass teacher. I don't say brass teacher either because of people mishear me in my accent. So last summer I was doing a lot of poetry things in the summer. I had a really nice long holiday, and then in September I was feeling really hacked up about going to work, and I normally do actually like my job, but I didn't want to go back. So I thought I would write a kind of rant about all the horrible things that the children have done to me over the years. The horrible things that have happened, actually. So these are all true as well, and I did a kind of curse on them, which sounds harsh. But luckily, I don't teach any of your children, so it's okay. So this is a trumpet teacher's curse. A curse on the children who tap the mouthpiece with the heel of their hand to make a popping sound, who drop the trumpet on the floor then laugh. A darker curse on those who fall with a trumpet in their hands and selfishly save themselves. A curse on the boy who dropped a pencil on the bell of his trombone to see if it did what I said it would. A curse on the girl who stuffed a pom-pom down her cornet and then said it was her invisible friend who did it. A curse on the class teacher who sits at the back of the room and does her paperwork. A curse on the teacher who says, I'm rubbish at music, in a loud enough voice for the whole class to hear. A curse on the father who coated his daughter's trumpet valves with Vaseline because he thought it was the thing to do. A curse on the boy who threw up in his baritone as if it was his own personal bucket. Let them be plagued with the urge to practice every day without improvement. Let them play in concerts each weekend which involve marching and outdoors and coldness. Let their family be forced to give up their Saturdays listening to bad music in village halls, or spend their Sundays at the bandstand, them, one dog and the drunk who slept there the night before, taking up the one and only bench. God's let it rain. I read my poems to my mum and dad over the phone because they're not poets, so they're good people to try them on. And my mum said at the end of that, well, that was just my life for 15 years, which I thought was harsh. I think I did improve a little bit. Now, I would normally read the title poem of my first full collection, which is coming out next year here, but I did a reading on Saturday night and somebody asked me if they could have it and I stupidly gave it to them. So I haven't got it, so never mind. But I'll find the other one. Right, so my dad is a scaffolder. He doesn't talk very much. He doesn't really get a word in. But I interviewed him for this poem. Sounds quite posh, doesn't it? So this is a psalm for the scaffolders. A psalm for the scaffolders who balanced like tightrope walkers, who could run up the bracing faster than you or I could climb a ladder, who wore red shorts and worked bare-chested, who cut their safety vests in half. A psalm for the scaffolders and their vans, their steel toe-capped boots, their coffee mugs. A psalm for those who learnt to put up a scaffold standing on just one board. A psalm for the scaffolder who put a 6-inch nail in a piece of wood with just his palm. A psalm for those who don't like rules or things taking too long, who now mustn't go to work uncovered, who mustn't cut their safety vests or climb without ladders, who must use 3 boards at all times. A psalm for the scaffolders who fall with a harness on, who have 10 minutes to be rescued. A psalm for the scaffolder who fell in a clear area, a tube giving way, that long, slow fall. A psalm for him who fell 30 feet and survived. A psalm for the scaffolder who saw him fall. A psalm for those who answer their phones at the top of buildings, the wind whistling in their ears, the sky in their voices, for those who lift and carry and shout and swear, for those who can recite the lengths of boards and tubes like a song. A psalm for them, the ones who don't like heights but spent their whole life hiding it. A psalm for those who work too long. A psalm for my father, a psalm for him. This one's, I went to see my niece in a boxing fight, she's only 15, and it ended really badly, well not really badly, it ended badly, and I really wanted to write a poem about it, but I thought I couldn't take advantage of her misery, and then she asked me if I would, so I did. But she said, I'm not allowed, if I ever read the poem out, I'm not allowed to tell people specifically what happened, I have to just say it ended badly. But that's not obvious at all. And I've gone backwards. Because that's what I wanted to do. I wish I could turn it backwards. So Boxer. Let me just check I've got the second page. Right. Boxer. If I could make it happen backwards, just with words, so you could start again, then I would. Beginning with you on the floor. The doctor in slow motion reversing from the ring. The screams of the crowd pulled back in their throats. Your coach, arms outstretched, retreats to the corner as men get down from chairs and tables. And you rise again, so tall, standing in that stillness in the seconds before you fell. And the other girl, the fighter, watch her arm move around and away from your jaw. And your mother rises from her knees, her hands still shaking as the second round unravels itself, and instead of moving forward as your little Irish coach told you to, you move away, back into the corner, where he takes your mouth guard out as gently as if you were his own. The water flies like magic from your mouth and back into the bottle, and the first round is in reverse, your punches unrolling to the start of the fight, when the sound of the bell this time will stop you dancing as you meet in the middle, when you come and touch gloves and whisper good luck and you dance to your corners again, your eyes fixed on each other as the song you chose to walk into sings itself back to its opening chords, and your coach unwraps your head from the head guard, unfastens your gloves, and you're out of the ring with your groin guard, your breast protector. You're striding round that room full of men, a warrior even before you went in.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read maybe two more of that, okay? Two more. And this this is a letter to an ex-boyfriend who I'm really good friends with and who really annoys me at the same time. And it's at the minute, it's in the manuscript of the collection, but I might take it out because I think he'd be really upset if he read it. And there's no way I can disguise it because I've been quite harsh. It depends if he pisses me off when I put it in. This is a letter to an ex-boyfriend. I need the second page as well. Nothing has changed. You still live at home with your mum at the edge of an estate with lawns edged with garden gnomes. It's a 10-minute walk to the canal, which is so full of water today I could reach down and easily stroke its back. It is so full another day's rain could tip it over the edge. How many years are you going to show me your initials carved on the side of the bridge? How many times will you tell me about the day you were thrown into the water? I no longer get that clutch of fear at my throat when I think of how you could have died before I met you. Your mother immovable still, and you on some sort of epic quest to leave, which you fail at every 6 months or so. You were telling me again of how you toy with the idea of living on a boat, and I want to say, go on then, do it or don't do it, but don't keep talking about it every year as if it's exciting talking about it, because it isn't. Don't keep telling me you're tired again, you're sad again. Did you know I can't remember your bedroom? Did you know this is the first time we've met and I didn't want to touch your arm for old time's sake? Remember 1 year you helped me over the stile and left your hand a second too long on my waist? And I felt it again, the dizziness, like vertigo but less dramatic. I didn't know your ambition was to get a 22-year-old girlfriend, like your brother who has a problem with drink and keeping a house clean, but manages, you tell me, to get a beautiful girl or a pretty little thing, as you call her, to sit on his knee and be all over him. I want to say, do you ever wake up and worry about becoming a cliche? But I don't. I can't be bothered to keep being disappointed in you and the way your beautiful animal face turned out. There's no disguising that, is there? I'm going to read another horrible poem to finish up. This is called My People, and I'm reading this because of the election that's been going on and the awful things that are happening in England with UKIP, and it's just, I'm embarrassed to be from there. They've come top in the election, and this is the closest to actual politics that I get, I think. So thank you for having me, and thank you, Paul, for inviting me. My people. I come from people who swear without realising they're swearing. I come from scaffolders and plasterers and shoemakers and carers, the type of carers paid pence per minute to visit an old lady's house. Some of my people have been inside a prison. Sometimes I tilt towards them and see myself reflected back. If they were from Yorkshire, which they're not, but if they were, they would have been the ones on the pickets shouting scab and throwing bricks at policemen. I come from a line of women who get married twice. I come from a line of women who bring up children and men who go to work. If I knew who my people were, in the time before women were allowed to work, they were probably the women who were working anyway. If I knew who my people were before women got the vote, they would not have cared about the vote. There are many arguments among my people. Nobody likes everybody. In the times of slavery, my people would have had them if they were the type of people who could afford them, which they probably weren't. In the time of casual racism, some of my people would and will join in. My people do not have a long history of thinking. Some of my people know everybody who lives on their street. They are the type of people who argue with the teacher if their child has detention. The women of my people are wolves, and we talk to the moon in our sleep. Thank you.
Thank you.